Write On Audio, the podcast for writers and all who are interested in books, literature, and the printed word. Write On Audio is the weekly companion podcast of Write On magazine and the Write On suite of publications from Pen to Print. Subscribe by searching Pen to Print in your favourite podcast app to have new editions delivered to you each week. Write On Audio interviews, inspiring you to write by sharing the experience of prominent authors. Our June interview is with children's and young adults author Sita Brahmachari. Sita's debut novel, Artichoke Hearts, won the Waterstones Children's Book Prize. And her latest novel, When Shadows Fall, was shortlisted for the Yoto Carnegie Award. The interviewer is Amber Hall.
Hi, Sita. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I just wanted to talk today about your latest book, When Shadows Fall, which has been shortlisted for the Yoto Carnegie Medal for Writing. So congratulations. Something that really comes through for me in your work is this fundamental belief in art and love and empathy, and how those things can also be, they seem to be like panaceas for trauma, for dealing with the shadows that we face in life. So with that in mind, it's a bit of a big question to start on, but what does love mean to you?
Everything, really. I think it's the pathway to everything, because in a lifetime, we know, you know, that this sort of this idea of life being an eternal quest for happiness and everyone should be happy all of the time. We know that, you know, in any given day, life can throw challenges at us. In my stories, I think one of the things I try to do is hold the reader. And the thing that is held in the voice, I feel it's something I always want to have, whatever I'm writing about, however difficult the process a character is going through is that it's held by this sense of the person whose energy is going into this story doesn't want to let you fall, that will try to find ways and characters and pathways where there's always light, even if it's kind of far away, glimmering at the edges. It's somewhere there. And that's kind of what love is. And, you know, love and life just feel synonymous to me. And I, as you said, in my stories, I have many different characters from many different places. And quite often they are uprooted or having to start life and make connections again. But I think one of the things that love brings to that storytelling is a sense that there can be so many different kinds of love. I suppose I'm wanting to open up an empathy portal for people to say, wow, if you open your, which you do as a writer, if you open your eyes to all of the different kinds of love there are, it's going to be a better story for all of us.
In a way to connect as well. I think that's the fundamental thing. Like empathy is such a connecting tool. And I think we so often forget that. I think to really feel someone's pain and hold it is actually quite a difficult thing for a lot of us to do, because just societally we've been taught that emotions are scary. And I know this from my own experience. I recovered from an eating disorder. So I think it's really important, the power of agency when you're processing those shadow moments. And it's always really interesting to me that there's this idea that kind of marginalized or vulnerable people can only be presented as kind of victims rather than as individuals with unique stories to tell and something special to offer.
I think that it's so rewarding when people pick something up in your work, which is a real key. It's kind of one of, again, I mean, love and how you hold with sensitivity and nuance is one of the most important ones. And the other things that I feel is in my hands when I'm writing any story is to think, I think first about what would it be like for my character to read this story. So Omid, who is the refugee survivor in When Shadows Fall, I think, what would it be like for Omid to find something of himself in this story? What will the book give him?
Yeah.
I wrote a story, which actually didn't get published long ago, about a girl called Orla, who only ate an apple a day, and she was reducing herself into the smallest person that she could be because she felt she was invisible to the world, but it was her internal voice. And I was thinking then, at that time, mental health and well-being wasn't so much explored in young people's work. And I think there was a great tentativeness to kind of show that work. But I would always think of what it was like for Orla to read that book and what I would want her to get out of it and her journey through. So I do sort of, when I'm writing these characters, I mean, which are often based on a lot of connection, sometimes over many, many, many years with either individuals or groups. I'm never writing somebody else's story, but I'm taking a sense of the sensibility of what it's like to live in particular kinds of difficulty and then bringing them to my characters. For example, within the refugee sector, I've worked for many, many years. So a lot of Omid's story is not anyone's individual story, but it is the kind of things that I feel will resonate to many people. So there's a kind of truth that I'm looking for, which absolutely has to be there. But as in When Shadows Fall, the pen is in Kai's hand and he is writing the story. So Kai becomes Omid's friend. Kai is the journal writer in When Shadows Fall. And he says, I'm going to take you into some difficult places, but just remember I'm here and the pen is in my hand. So for each of the characters that I write, I do a plot. I actually have in my notebooks a plot, and it's a plot to how empowered they are at different points in the story. And for me, it always has to be a journey to those young people feeling agency and power. Mm. That has to be the experience, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's just something so powerful about writing, I think, people a sense of agency. It's just sort of saying, here I am, this is my story. But I mean, I know that you've worked with a lot of young people as well. And how have you noticed that writing can kind of facilitate that sense of empowerment or that sense of giving voice to people, especially marginalized people?
Yes, I mean, really, that's always been my work. From leaving university, I went and worked at, I was very lucky to get this job at the Royal Court Young People's Theatre. It's called Community Theatre Worker. I love the title. You don't get titles like that anymore. I love the idea of community theatre worker, those three things together, because it is work. It's not work that happens easily. That work where you go into different communities and you say to people, we know you don't think that that place up the road, that place could be a theatre or that place could be a museum or a gallery or a book, even publishing. We know you think that's not for you. And we know you feel that so many things are outside of your control or you're not invited in. And the Royal Court Young People's Theatre at that time was in Ladbroke Grove and it was just opposite. So I did a lot of work near Trellick Towers, which is this big tower block there opposite Grenfell Tower. And I worked in a people referral unit for excluded young people. And my job was to go in and tell stories, bring stories, get people to feel that their stories were part of the fabric of what storytelling and theatre would be. And then if those young people got really excited about doing that work, which they very often did, they would come back to the Young People's Theatre and they would think of themselves as storytellers and theatre makers. So it's literally the thread that connects all of my work. What I saw, I'm going to tell you a story actually that was a kind of really important story for When Shadows Fall, because I started writing that book right at the beginning when I was doing that work. I started thinking about that book and there was a particular moment in the scene that made me think I needed to write a story like When Shadows Falls. Obviously, it's changed many times and had many iterations. But yeah, so I was working with these brilliant young women who were like 14, 15 years old, who already kind of felt, and they were all, I think, of Black Caribbean heritage. And I was a young person myself going in there thinking, how can this be that these brilliant young storytellers who've got so much to offer already think they're outside of the school, already have been placed outside of the school gate? They were absolutely, I would still picture them in my mind. I still picture their brilliance. And there was a particular, say, there would always be a social worker there, and often there'd be behavioural difficulties. And there was one particular young woman who she was really getting into a scene, and sometimes it would take quite a long time to get people to cooperate. And she was really getting into this character. And suddenly the social worker called across the space and kind of interrupted the story and said, that's my necklace. And the young woman said, what do you mean? She clasped her necklace. And she said, the social worker said, my car was broken into. And that was my grandmother's necklace. And it was really precious to me. And you've got it. And I saw this look on this young woman's face. I'll never forget it. It was like all the edges disappeared. And there were lots of edges and protection and masks. And she just collapsed and the tears were just rolling down her face. And she said, and she grabbed it and she took it off and she was literally pushing it into the social worker's hand. And she said, if I'd have known it was you, I never, ever would have taken it. You know that. You're the only person that's always had my back. And I just thought, wow, here is this extraordinary person that basically has huge potential for love, huge potential for empathy, but she just doesn't trust anyone. And that's the missing link. I mean, I think love and trust, they're two things that are very connected. And so that sort of made me think, oh, yes, you know, these people, these young people who already are on the outside, where are they going to go? And what is holding them in society is a very, very, and particularly now, even more so. At least then there was a youth club. At least then there was a youth theatre. Now there aren't those things. And so these kind of very, very fragile threads that hold the most or don't hold the most vulnerable young people was always a story that I was going to be telling. Yeah.
I think that really comes through as well. And yeah, and I think there's just no foresight with how things like that are managed. Like there's no foresight in thinking, how can we support young people to flourish, to thrive? There's no thinking ahead. There's just labeling bad behavior and we don't see those layers of trauma and those things as a protective barrier, like you say.
Well, like you were saying also, you know, about your own journey.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, really important. And now it is happening that people, you know, a few years ago, nobody interviewing you would have said what you just said. You know, it's opening up of the conversations across generations and not leaving young people sort of in this sort of place of silence. Because yeah. I think that's, again, whatever traumatic situation people are going through, you know, silence is the killer one.
Yeah. And I think actually there's so many shared feelings, like at the root so much is shame and anxiety, but we don't really talk about that. We talk about the symptoms of things.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And again, I think, you know, in so many situations, whatever your, you know, personal challenges are or difficulties, when you see those things resonating in someone else's story, even if it's a story of somebody completely unlike you, whatever, it opens up. Or even, you know, quite often I'll write a character who, in the first instance, is quite unlikable. Then you sort of start to pull the layers in my first novel, which was Ashes at Heart. The metaphor was the layers of the heart. And Jide Jackson, who again is a refugee survivor from Rwanda, who's the kind of romantic hero in that story for young, sort of middle grade young teens, he has a well-protected heart. And the protagonist, Mira, her nana gives her an artichoke charm. And the nana says, you know, you know, some people as they grow older get really tough little layers around their hearts, like the outside layers of an artichoke, which you don't eat. But she says, as you pull away the layers, you get closer to the heart, and that's the bit that's valuable. And Mira realizes that Jide Jackson has very good reason to have a very well protected heart because of the things that have happened to him. He's had to survive. And so I think for me, sometimes the process of writing is to peel back some of those layers of people who might seem to be very, you know, difficult to be with, or actually, you know, frankly, completely dislikable in the first instance. But then it's a very different process than a kind of, you know, sort of divided and fissured society where we go, that person's good and that person's bad.
Yeah.
That person's ill, that person's well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually sort of touched on that. So you use a lot of symbolism and poetry, kind of mixed forms in your work, and you reference nature quite a lot as well. And it seems like you use these things to kind of access a world just beyond reach, as though you're trying to tap into kind of fundamental human truths. But I just wondered whether you could tell me a bit about your process around that. Whether you have any I don't know, kind of rituals around writing or anything?
Often I will start with walking out in nature, and I feel like that thing about looking up, look up, look down, look right, look left, that, you know, which is well known for people who, you know, sort of work with anyone's well-being really, or any pursuit. But, you know, look, just see something and notice something outside of yourself, your own reality. But walking in nature has been really important to me. I grew up in the Lake District, and then in Shropshire. And so that I was always quite sort of, you know, in that sort of emotion recollected in tranquility, in that sort of Wordsworthian way. Even as a very young child, I was like always very connected to the sort of emotional landscape that is everywhere in nature.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, it's always been an inspiration. So like in When Shadows Fall, I give that to Kai, who's struggling with his mental health. He notices the ravens and the ravens notice him.
Yeah.
And quite often, you know, nature isn't this kind of like sweet little thing that, you know, it isn't that. So first of all, Kai fears the ravens, and there's all sorts of kind of, you know, symbolism around ravens that he might have taken in as a child. But his father says to him, no, don't fear the ravens, Kai, look to the shine in their eye. And I say, I think nature can teach us so much about, you know, facing up to changing weathers and realizing our own small place sometimes when you're like looking at, you're looking up at the mountains, or, you know, the weather going across a fell, or, and, you know, you don't just climb the fell, you know, with your t-shirt and shorts on, because, you know, you just think, oh, I want to climb that fell. The weather can come in.
Mm.
And so for me, it's very, very connected. It's almost like, you know, I place the characters in the story, and I will actually do a kind of weather map. I'm very visual as a writer. So obviously in this novel, the amazing illustrator, Natalie Syrett, has been there to kind of to create in image what sometimes Omid can't articulate in words. But he's an amazing artist. But I sort of do, that is my process. I will draw stuff out. I have lots of maps in my notebooks, and I will actually do almost like a graph of the weather of the character through the story. In Kite Spirit, which was a story which was set in the Lake District, the character Kite is dealing with a terrible grief of her best friend Dawn. And in that story, I played with the weather so much and what the landscape was doing to that character, that I decided that instead of having the rainy Lake District as you would have imagined it, I would make a summer which was completely blue sky and drought, because she was unable to express her emotions. And the journey of the book was for her to actually understand what this meant to her, this grief. So I had got into the book thinking, oh yes, you know, the grey weather's going to come in across the fell and she's going to feel this mood. And then I thought, no, the opposite is going to be blue skies, and she's going to be trapped in this place where everyone's expecting her to move on and feel better. And yeah, so I will play with landscape and weather very much. And I do believe that people's landscapes, the landscapes of their childhood, really forge them, which is why in When Shadows Fall, this piece of wild woodland that Kai and Omid and Orla and Zach and their families live on, which is just a bit of urban wreck, really. You know, it doesn't have to be a beautiful sort of wild landscape like Lake District. In an urban setting where I now live, that local wreck, that local park, is that place that allows the young people to look up, see out of themselves, connect to nature, plant trees that signify happiness or sadness. They plant, literally, I think we as humans plant ourselves into different landscapes. And each of those landscapes, someone like Omid has had to move from Aleppo and see his landscape completely destroyed. But him and his aunt Shizu and their family, they are replanting themselves very slowly into this new piece of kind of urban, it's called a wreck, a piece of wild wilderness that Kai and his family have kind of reclaimed. And the idea that landscape is to be lost to developers is so awful. It was so awful to me to think that these characters don't have a back garden. This is their communal space. But also, it's not like they need that space. They literally need that space to grow. They call it the land of their growing. But actually, what I hope that is seen in a lot of my storytelling is that this communal space is the space. It's actually a much better space, this sort of sharing space, because actually everyone in that community, in that book, grows through the difficulties that they've faced.
Yeah, there is a real sense of that community and that the power of belonging in the story that definitely comes through. I think community is so important in kind of healing and also facilitating creativity. But I wonder what you think about that.
On this rep, Omid and Kai, they have a bothy. And a bothy, those people who've been to Scotland will know, it's a free space where anyone can go, you know, in the Highlands, to shelter from the weather. Sometimes gardeners or, people who are bringing in livestock will use them. So I have in the past, in the story, I don't think it's a spoiler, an old man who had actually, as a boy, had left school early and was coming to work in London. And he built a little bothy on this piece of wreck that I've described. It's now all kind of dismantled. But these young characters desperately need a place to make art. In my introduction, I say to make art from scorched earth. And Omid's earth literally has been scorched. But actually, there's more than one way to scorch an earth by depriving people of essential things. So Kai and Omid come together. And in fact, all of the young people in the book come together at some point, first of all, to build dens, but later in their teen years into this bothy. And they make of it what they need. So they tell stories to each other. They paint. Omid is painting his Aleppo sky, which is gone. But he's painting himself back. He's painting the things that he needs back into this new landscape. And Kai is doing his b-boy dancing wildly on the wreck, pretending to be a raven. He's finding a physical way to shrug off some of the trauma that he is experiencing from a very real sadness that happens in his family. And they are literally in a free space where they are finding ways themselves with their own agency. They're kind of teaching each other to find creative ways to navigate a way through difficult times. And I think one of the things that I loved when in the book is that I was able to move that free space out of a wild and potentially dangerous place for the young people, because anyone can go there. And it can be a place that people will want to break. That free space, people will want to say, it's too wild. We don't consider that to be art. Or, people will want to have an opinion on what those young people are doing in that free space or what's allowed in. I was able to find a space in school, which was the art room, where Omid and Kai met. And Omid just sits and he makes Kai understood that Kai has been seen. So that idea within the arts of, actually, I think all of the arts are really about that sort of sense of when you're interacting with another human being or animal or landscape, the attention that you bring to it. So for me, one of my favourite bits of that book is where Omid and Kai are in the art room at school and Omid draws Kai and Kai draws Omid. And they are literally looking into each other's eyes. And I think Omid says something like, people do not see enough the language, the emotion of the language in the eyes, or the truth in the language of the eyes. And yeah, I think we don't give young people that attention in society.
Yeah, I was thinking that because I was wondering whether you've ever had to, you deal with, there's some really harrowing things in your work, in the book and in your other work, but I always wonder, given that you write for young adults, have you ever felt this pressure to kind of adapt your voice? Or do you think we undermine young people's ability to hold bigger emotions a lot of the time?
Yes, that completely. I think adults will often be really worried about often when somebody said to me the other day, I read your book. She said, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be from the things that I read on the back. She said it really went into things much more deeply than I thought that it was going to. I think there's a tentativeness to say what things are.
Yeah.
However, that is measured. So the thing that I think is that over 100,000 refugee children are walking this world today. The children that, I mean, from Artichoke Hearts onwards, Mira Levinson was sitting next to Jidda Jackson, a Rwandan refugee, in her school. It's like, who do we think we're writing children's books for? This is what I don't understand. And it's like, so are children's and young adult books for a particular kind of people then? Yeah. Is it a sort of a nice other thing that is something else, which is supposed to do something else? Because I've never felt it is. All of the great sort of myths and stories that, you know, there wasn't really like a genre of young adult fiction when I was growing up. But, you know, the stories before, you know, the Grimm's fairy tales or, you know, the classic fairy tales, if you look at them, they are everything. I'm wanting to go for that when I'm writing stories that actually, I do really want young people to read my work, but many, many adults read my work and go, oh God, that viscerally reminded me of that rites of passage. And I was like, yeah, because there's all the gen. Why do we think of young people as siloed into this place? And then suddenly, what, at 18, or, you know, some more enlightened people say 25, that you're suddenly able to be in a sort of adult space. Yeah. I just wanted to tell you another little narrative because it came to me yesterday. I wasn't sure, you know, when you write a book, you know, the characters are 18 or whatever, and they're looking back to that young, you know, to write back to nursery, and they're just about to step out. I mean, it could be read by, you know, my youngest children going to university. It's that rites of passage. They could be thinking about themselves forward. Equally, you know, it's on the Carnegie shadowing, so it's been read by shadowers. I was thinking, you know, that thing about age limits on books and stuff like that. I was thinking, well, who, you know, how would, okay, I've written it with all of these characters in mind, and they're at different ages in the story. And so you see Kai when he's a little boy in nursery, just going into school. So how will the year seven read it? How will the year eight read it? How will the sixth former read it? How will the one person that's at university read it? Or maybe Dex, the father, who's the saxophonist, whose son it is who's writing the story. Maybe how will they each read it? So I had an email yesterday from a librarian to say that they had a year seven student that came into their library, who spends a lot of time in their library, who gets through about a book a day, which is a great challenge for the librarian. And they have to keep providing him books that they think, but he doesn't speak very much. So they decided to, the librarian decided to give him the shadowing books. And he'd had When Shadows Fall and came back. And he just stood at the desk and gave it to the librarian. And quite often, you know, she'll ask, you know, did you like it? She said, very rarely he'll say, good. Very rarely. And he stood there for quite a long time, and he just went, very, 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 very. And she thought he wasn't going to stop. Good.
Oh.
And then she said that's the most she'd heard of about him. So she tried to get more. And she said, and which of the characters did you spoke to you? And he said, Omid.
Oh, bless.
So you can understand why. And then she said, and which of the pictures did you like? Because it's a young adult book, which is illustrated as beautifully. There's Kai holding his journal that he's writing. And he said, the boy at the beginning. And that was it. And I have to tell you, that is just about the thing that's made me happiest.
Oh,
I mean, obviously, he wouldn't have got that book if it wasn't on the shadowing, or he might not have been brought to his attention. But yeah, he's year seven, so that surprised me. That surprised me that it spoke to the interiority of a young person who's experiencing life from a different perspective with autism, and that it spoke to him. That means a really lot to me. Yeah,
that's lovely. I also wanted to touch on, I mean, we've sort of talked about it a little bit, but you're a writer in residence at the Islington Centre for Refugees and Migrants. And I wondered, I mean, in the current climate, it feels so hostile. People have always been othered, but I think particularly at the moment, there's so much scapegoating and kind of untruth circling online and in the media about that refugee experience. And we rarely hear about it from the refugees themselves. But how do you think storytelling can kind of help to reclaim that narrative for refugees and migrants?
So yeah, the Islington Centre for Refugees and Migrants. I was actually there yesterday with well, the day before yesterday with Jane Ray, who is the artist in residence who first invited me to be there over a decade ago now, and to work with her in an art and writing class, and also with Ros Asquith, and the three of us now run that art and writing class together. I have people who've said to me, how can you have done that work for so long and do that work and not just feel totally depressed? And I say the opposite. The opposite is, because what you're seeing this hideous sort of vitriol and hatred, the opposite of love, coming from the language is a very, very high level of government, from people whose families would never have been even in this country if they had not been welcomed through refugee journeys. We know those people. Then you go to the refugee centre and you get into the art and writing room. We took it online during lockdown. We're going to be going back soon. But you go into a communal space. Over there is a dance company working with a few people. Over there, there's somebody serving some food. Over there, there's somebody helping somebody that needs help with their housing. And here we've got a table, an art and writing table set up with some branches and leaves, or, you know, some stimulation. And people are sitting and drawing, often for the first time, sometimes in the case of men who have been child soldiers and have been robbed of an education, or women who've never had that opportunity to do art or to just express themselves in writing, sometimes for the first time in their life, they are in that bodily space, in that art space, where they're feeling who they are in relation to the journey that they've been on, and they're finding a way to move through it in art. And you're in that space and you look up and you go, oh, this is the best of humanity. This is the best that we can be. And when we went back into, because in lockdown, we took the classes online, because it was so, can you imagine how difficult it would be for clients at the centre? So keeping that connection
going, yeah.
It's horrendous. I mean, you saw even more in lockdown the horrendousness of the situation. Yeah. At least at the centre, we have this place that we can create where whatever difficulties people face, and, you know, the horrendousness of accommodation or homelessness or, you know, poverty, you don't see it on a screen.
Yeah.
We're together in that space, and we can, for that moment, people from all over the globe can come together and be in a communal space, which might be a little bit like a communal space in a village somewhere, you know, on the other side of the globe, and sometimes speak the same language and just be in each other's company and feel a sense of home in each other. So the movement for me is, yes, I've always wanted to include these characters in stories, but also to own voice work, to develop other people's, help develop other people to their voices. And I was so proud that the other Side of Hope, the anthology, I don't know if you know it, but it's a fantastic international anthology of refugee writers, has been published, and it includes a patchwork of storytelling poems from the refugee center, from our arts and writing class, and then online there's a whole collection of work which is from our clients at the center. And it's my hope that the Omids will then become the next writers.
Thank you to Sita Brahmachari for featuring in today's interview. You can find out much more about Sita and order her books by visiting her website, sitabrahmachari.com. We'll post a link in our show notes. We're always delighted to read your contributions. So if you'd like to see your words in Write On or hear them on this podcast, please get in touch. We'll share this link and all others mentioned in today's podcast as part of our show notes. I've been Tiffany Clare, and you've been listening to Write on Audio. Write on Audio is produced by Chris Gregory, and it's an alternative stories production for pen to print. This podcast is supported using public funding by Arts Council England.